Hi, I'm Candace Michelle, and this is Our Community. Diana Cooper, Executive Director of Brookings Core Response, is back with me today, and I think we've got a pretty interesting show ahead of us. So how are you doing, Diana?
I'm good. I also think we have an interesting show ahead of us. And right? I don't always, sometimes I'm like, after I'm done talking, I'm like, who listens to me and is interested? But sometimes I think it's an interesting topic and I get really excited about it. And so, you know, I'm definitely excited about today. So,
yeah, exactly. And I always want to check in with you about your COVID, long haul COVID. How are you doing with all of that?
I had a little bit of a relapse, not with, you know, I didn't test positive for COVID, but I had a little bit of a relapse with my symptoms. And so I was struggling with a lot of fatigue and some headaches and joint pain. But weirdly, also the tinnitus was really giving me a hard time, which is such a weird thing to have happen, to just be fine and then one day just like have tinnitus. And so
Well, isn't it a weird side effect? I mean, it's like, where does it...
Yeah. Because I'm not... Just weird. I'm not sure that I understand why there. I think that it has something to do with the fevers, because that would makes sense to me, because if you think about, you know, all of the... What were the scarlet fever and things like that that kids used to get, and it could actually cause deafness. So, you know, it could have something to do with that. I definitely know a lot more about some of the other symptoms, because that one's new, but... Sometimes I'll just be standing there and my ear, it'll just suddenly go dead and have a buzz. And I, who knows when it's coming back, you know? And then I can't hear out of that ear for a while. It's like being underwater, but only one ear. It's very weird.
Well, I'm glad it's only one.
Yeah, no, it's not. I mean, nothing happened in my left ear
at the same time. Isn't that
weird? Would be so strange, because I think I would lose balance. Right? I already kind of do lose balance when it happens. And I thought about that too, that I wonder if that's an issue, like when people go deaf, you know, if you're born deaf, that could be a lot different. But if you go deaf, it's like being in outer space, your equilibrium doesn't make any sense. And so you have to relearn. Anyway, I was thinking about that the other day when I was half deaf.
Yeah. So when you kind of hit the wall with that fatigue stuff, I'm assuming that there's not much to do except just lay down and rest.
I did. Well, and some of the fatigue is really weird, and there's probably a lot of people that can relate to this, but some kinds of fatigue, you can't actually sleep. And so it's just it's almost like you can't sleep, but you're fatigued and you're drained. But then there's times where I just want to sleep all the time, and obviously I can't. I have a lot to do. But yeah, I don't know. I just move slow. And like a couple weeks ago, for the last few weeks, if I... go to do something, like something that would normally, you know, I'd jump in my car and run to the bank real quick and deposit something and come home. Boy, that's like, I could be exhausted the rest of the day after that. And that's so strange. Yeah. You know, I'm 34. Yep. I just turned 34. And so that's not who I am, not who I've ever been. I've had a lot of illnesses before and I've bounced back. I mean, I had meningitis, I had mono, I had all kinds of things. So, you know, it's a little bit frustrating. I think my want for progress physically, and a lot of people too, a lot of us out there who are struggling with this, we want to see more progress, both internally. We want to see more, we want to see our bodies healing faster. We're not sure what that's about. There's not a lot of really good research on that. There's a lot of information, but when it comes to some of the answers that we need, we don't have those yet. So there are a lot of people who are just sort of disappointed with their own personal health progress, but also disappointed with kind of the system and how slow, you know, it takes right now. You know, my referral was denied at OHSU, and there's no, currently there's no reason why it would be accepted if I reapplied until January, because they say a year after your diagnosis is when you would be eligible for long COVID clinic. But we know that early detection of these kinds of chronic health conditions and early treatment can really make the difference. Because what if in a year we discover, oh, you know what, actually COVID is still within our bodies causing damage. And if we take care of ourselves and take care of our our health, you know, that'll be a lot better. So there's still a lot more information out there that we need to know.
Well, I'm looking forward to that actually happening for us, you know, to get more information. And I'm sure there are studies going on, and I certainly hope that they continue and find some answers, because it is so frustrating when you are otherwise okay,
mm-hmm.
except you've got this thing called long COVID that, you know, is kind of out of the blue and hits you whenever it wants to. And it's like, wow.
Mm-hmm. And wow. When you're
frustrating,
you know, when you're, I guess, I don't know. I still think I'm young. Am I young or am I middle-aged? Is 34 middle?
No, honey, you're very
okay.
young. You're very young.
So I'm young.
34 is very young. Yes. Yes.
Okay. Well, yes. That makes me feel better.
Yeah. So, first of all, there's big news for CORE.
Mm-hmm.
The organization has a new home, mm-hmm. right? You want to tell us?
No, I think I'll just... That? No, I'm just kidding. Just keep it...
You'll just make me guess, right?
Keep it a mystery.
I mean, let's start with the dream that you had, because that's really where this started, right?
Well, it's where it started for me.
You had a dream.
It's what's mm-hmm. been so interesting about this is understanding my own personal journey and seeing, I mean, I'm a very religious person, although to be clear, I don't really attend church. Well, I do attend online sometimes. I don't read the Bible as often as probably a lot of people do, but I am very spiritual in my own Christianity. And so I've always felt very tuned in to what I think God wants for me. And so what's been really interesting is to look back and see all these moments that where I thought, like, gosh, I really want to do this, or I really need this, and then to see them come true later without even really realizing it. And so another interesting part is like seeing all of the people that have been on their own spiritual journey, whatever their religion or non-religion, but their own journey for their own life, and meeting them all at this place where I've been trying to get to, like Michelle and you and, you know, Cherry, and just all of the people that are so involved. And obviously, you know, Bernie and Beth, and there's like almost too many people to name. I think that's why it's hard to do it, because I would just have to name like 100 people. So
I know, and you're bound to leave somebody.
I know.
Out,
so
right?
Sorry. There's so many people. I think that there's the dream is like, I have my personal dream. And then of course there's, you know, the vision that Michelle and I, when we connected with, and when I started at St. Timothy's, that Bernie and I talked about, mm-hmm. and all of these different visions that have come together. But my own personal dream was that, you know, once I got to treatment, and I actually started going to college when I had about 9 months clean. So I'm coming up on, almost nine. Yeah, I'm coming up on 9 years clean. So when I had to like count for a second, because I forgot what last year I celebrated.
Yeah.
So in June, that'll be 9 years. But when I had 9 months clean, I started college, and I was actually still in treatment. We had to go to treatment 20 hours a week. And so if we worked, we had to kind of work around those schedules. But I started college then. And as soon as I started college, I mean, when I started treatment, I had those early dreams and visions of wanting to be a treatment counselor, because everybody does when they go to treatment. Not everybody, but a lot of people do, because they feel that sense of wanting to give back, because they feel so blessed to be alive, because a lot of us think we're going to die out there. I definitely felt that. I felt that I was saved for a reason and I wanted to give back. And I started college. And when I started that kind of my trajectory changed, and it all, it all ended up with me being at All Care back in 2016. And I learned what care coordination was. It's interesting being someone who's been a consumer of these services for so long and then getting into the system and kind of seeing like, oh, that's why I couldn't get this, or that's why this is this way. And so you see sort of the inner workings of a system that you've been mostly just viewing from the outside. And I wanted to...
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an amazing thing to be able to do.
I mean, you do that. Everybody does that. When you start a job, you kind of get in there. I mean, think about the radio station and getting in and being like, oh, this is... they, mm-hmm. you know, and also in this work, sometimes it's like, oh, nobody knows how to do this. We're just figuring it out. So sometimes it's actually that. But it's very interesting.
We're all making it up as we go along.
But, you know, when I started working at Subway, it was kind of like, oh, that's what happens back behind the wall. And so that's really how it is. But what I think was so valuable is having the lived experience, anybody that has that lived experience of accessing a system, and especially those people who are struggling with accessing systems, then when they get into positions of being able to kind of see the inside, you know, they're able to, I think most people generally are able to kind of point out, like, that's what's not working there, or this, maybe we don't know how to fix it, but we can definitely see where we struggled.
But you can identify what needs to be fixed.
Yeah, so that's really where my dream came from. And the dream was that I would gather everything I could, any schooling. I went to school for several years, although I changed majors twice. And so I actually only ended up with an associate's. But I had an associate's in family support services, which is human services and like early childhood development and education and things like that. So it's really a lot of understanding the life cycle and, you know, start to finish. Mm-hmm. And even there was a lot of topics covered around end of life care and elderly. And, you know, that was particularly interesting to me because of our demographics here. So,
we've got a lot of older folks. Yep.
And I understood that we had a rural healthcare system, and that there were not a lot of people accessing it, whether it was for their own cultural beliefs. And I know over here, we do have quite the culture. You know, our own, we have a primarily conservative base here in Brookings and in Curry County. But even outside of that, just in general, myself as someone who's probably more liberal and progressive, I still hesitate going to the doctor, because when you don't really get specialty care, or you don't get a lot of really good care often. You know, I'm trying not to disparage a lot of the great doctors we've had around here, because we have had some really good doctors. But when you grow to expect that, you don't go to the doctor as often. So I wanted to find a way to bridge the gap between, I mean, initially it was between the seniors who live in our community and the people who have disabilities, and then the healthcare system. And I saw that. Mm-hmm. I saw community health workers as being really valuable in that, because they're lay people. They're a great return on investment. But even outside of that, they're people from the community and people who understand all of the, or a lot of the dynamics. So that was really my dream, was to come back here and start some sort of hub for community health workers and peers and doulas and other traditional health workers, and grow the workforce, and you know, just have an actual ownership in our community, because a lot of our services are based elsewhere and we tend to get kind of what's filtered to us. And even if that's not the intention, that is what happens. We're all very aware of that.
Right.
You know, if it's managed at a...
We really get the leftovers. We really do.
And that's why...
We get what's left
over. It's like, Coos curry. Okay, well, that's the order it goes in, too. It's Coos, then curry.
Yeah.
And right. And then, you know, there's probably more need in Coos, and so I do understand that part of it. And same with Jackson County. Obviously, there's more need, you know, in Josephine County. But I think it's time we focus on curry. So...
Well, I can totally agree with that. Yeah.
And I'm from Brookings, you know.
I mean, there's just not enough. There's not enough here. There are not enough services. There's not enough access to services. There's not enough. And, you know, we can understand all of the dynamics of that. We're rural. We're relatively poor county. I mean, you know, we know and understand all of those mm-hmm. components. Nevertheless, there's not one of us who lives here that is less deserving of care.
That's exactly right. And that's where...
than somebody who lives in Coos.
That's where we, I think, kind of miss a lot of where we could sort of change this dynamic and where we could shift this. Yeah, I think you're right. Essentially, I wanted to come back here and do that. I did a lot of volunteer work over in Jackson County with the Homeless Task Force and with Rogue Retreat, with the Kelly Shelter, with a lot of other organizations, but mostly, you know, working with people who are unsheltered. That was obviously one of my focuses when I thought about moving back, but mm-hmm. originally that wasn't the primary focus. But obviously getting back over here, you kind of see, well, the need's everywhere, but there's some people where we don't have time to wait for more resources. And so we just have to, it's sort of, right. we sort of are, you know, really bleeding out in some areas. And I don't mean to make it sound that dramatic, because I don't want to say we don't have resources.
Well, it is dramatic. Mm-hmm. I know, but it is dramatic. If we have people dying on the streets,
which we do,
it is dramatic.
It is certainly for us and everybody that knows them, and it's traumatic mm-hmm. as well. But, you know, I realize that not everybody is quite on the ground level, but we do need to talk about that, because it's getting to a point now where we've seen such an increase. And, you know, I don't know if we're going to see better access now that the pandemic's not over, but now that all these restrictions have been lifted and a lot of things are opening, including medical offices and a lot of mm-hmm. procedures and things like that. So I wonder if that's going to improve already on its own. But regardless of that, we have to get some safety nets in place. So, you know, so we needed that. And I did when I moved.
So how did you get? I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to ask how you got hooked up with St. Tim's, because that seems like that was the next step once you got over here.
Yeah. Once I got here, I thought I had a pretty serious health scare I had some health conditions going on at the end of 2018, and they caused me to have to leave my job. I was working two jobs and I was going to school. And so I left one of my jobs right away and then the other job shortly after. And so when I got here, I was actually really kind of scared to go into the workforce because, you know, they were so debilitating, the illnesses that I was going through. And, mm-hmm. but when they went into remission, you know, we were here and I was sort of feeling better, when the pandemic hit, that's when, and I still didn't really intend on going and doing anything yet, but the mm-hmm. need was there, the drive was there, and I also really felt spiritually compelled for several nights in a row, and so I ended mm-hmm. up just waking up one day and calling St. Tim's, and I think I spoke with Betty at first, and I was going to go down right away, but I had a COVID scare, not realizing I had already had COVID. Somebody near me who possibly got it from me when I had it, ended up saying that they were positive. And so I had been around them. So I waited until, April to go into St. Tim's. And mm-hmm. that's when I started just volunteering. I didn't want to work. 'Cause again, I just felt like, well, I don't have anything I can really contribute that I can promise to contribute, because I could be very sick or something. I could get sick again.
Right.
And so I just
right.
didn't want to let anyone down. But, you know, after a couple of weeks, it just feel, you know, God's hand in my life was just like moving everything out of the way and pushing me into that direction. And, you know, Matt lost mm-hmm. half of his job, and Bernie offered me what was basically the equivalent of that without even knowing that Matt lost his job. And so I just was like, well, All right.
I know.
This is the next right thing.
When that spirit is moving.
It's not always that obvious, though.
I mean, okay.
There are times where I'm like,
I don't know. Pretty much it is for me, you know? It's like, whoa. All right.
Sometimes I don't see it till afterward, but that one was very obvious. So, you know, I started there in April and then May. I think I met Michelle online in May. And we might have met first in June. And then by July, and I can't quite remember if it was July or August, because I don't remember when I had that scare of, there was several people that I thought had COVID. And I don't remember if that was in before the 4th of July or after. But so she started right around in there, and her and I were already communicating before she came down. We met a couple of times. We met down at the Nazarene Church to just try to see, okay, what do we want to try to do? Mm-hmm. And we reached out to several people. We were trying to kind of figure out a direction. Like, we had some ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really the start of me trying to formulate what all was in my head and get it out. And Michelle definitely had a lot of energy. And so it didn't take long.
That's excellent.
Yeah. She came down to St. Tim's, you know, like I said, probably a couple months later. And then she just sort of, I don't know, watching me and also just listening to people and, you know, using her own experience. And she kind of jumped right in. And, you know, I didn't really have to explain a lot. And it was
It's amazing how it snowballed.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you kind of stand back from it and look, it definitely snowballed.
And I wonder... You know, Bernie watching all of those dynamics happen over a period of time and just everybody evolving. We all have grown so much in the last couple of years. And then, you know, like a year after she started coming down, that's when we opened the clinic downstairs. And, you know, so that evolved. And then we kind of formed a little bit better and we brought more people on. I think we brought Jessica on shortly after the clinic, maybe a month or so after the clinic started. I can't quite remember.
Mm-hmm.
And then John just recently. And so, and we had April back at the beginning of 2021 for a little while. So, you know, we just started expanding the teams.
So now you've actually moved into another space.
Yeah, now we found an office.
Which is kind of, wow.
I know.
Right?
It's interesting because I don't know if maybe all of it hasn't quite sunk in yet or something. Maybe just because I've been so busy since it happened. Because, you know, I'm not like ecstatic or excited or something. I feel grateful. Mm-hmm. But I also feel like there's still so much to do. So it can be difficult sometimes, I think, to sit and appreciate it really fully how far we've come. But I did have a friend come over from Medford today who I haven't seen in several years. And, you know, her and I took the community health worker course several years ago. In fact, I think 2015 is when we took that course. And so, you know, she's heard me talk a lot about this. And so having her come over and see it and, you know, her and Michelle and I sitting around and talking, and it just felt like that was a moment that I could appreciate. Like, it kind of has happened. Yeah. And it, you know, Michelle says it all the time, and I know I say it, and Jessica and John and everybody, but I think it takes sometimes an outside person being like, look what's happened. But yeah, we're
exactly
in that space. We searched for offices. We found a couple in Brookings, and then we went and looked at some in Harbor at the shopping center, and we looked at several different ones, and two of them might have worked, but it would have just been office space, so we wouldn't have had any kind of day center. Mm-hmm. And then at the last second she showed us this building, and it was, you know, really set up for everything we need. So
that's perfect.
Yeah.
And you call it?
It's called Pier House.
What's the name?
Pier House is,
I love that.
Because we are peers.
So why is it called Pier House?
Yeah. Well, we want
because I love that
people to kind of feel as though it's their house in the way. You know, it's obviously it's not their mm-hmm. house, but we want them to feel when they walk in, like if they need to go sit down on the couch for a minute and plug in their phone, you know, before they come talk to us, or maybe they just need to do that and then they have other business they have to get done. You know, when I come home and I come sit on my couch, nobody's like, do you need something? I mean, sometimes. And it would be certainly nice sometimes if they did. But not in the way that most people generally, when you're low on resources and there's a space that's set up for resources, when you go in, it's not always the feeling of, like, this is your space and use what you need. And if you don't need something, then it's not going to be pushed on you. It's not always like that. Like, I don't, you know, it's not like you could go into DHS and sit down, plug in your phone, make some calls, sit and fill out paperwork. Like, I don't know. You couldn't heat up some coffee and...
No, you couldn't just hang out.
Yeah, DHS has a very specific purpose. It's like in the hospital, you know, it's not necessarily a space you could just go be. That's what we have our house for. But for people who either don't have a house, they have a house, but they are either very lonely, they don't have resources for utilities in the same way, or maybe it's just falling apart, because there are so many people in our community who are living in housing that is falling apart, and they are on low income or fixed incomes. And there's a lot of resources, too, that... if you own your own home, regardless of what shape it's in, you don't qualify for a lot of resources. And that's just really sad for people who are seniors or people who have disabilities because they are on fixed incomes. Or think about, you know, single parents who are on TANF, too. You cannot fix anything on that kind of an income. And you can't necessarily just go out and work. So we can provide some space for people to be. It's probably close to half of the space that we rent is just a big open center. And so it made sense to kind of have, you know, an area that, now we call these areas like living room, kitchen, but these are, you know, obviously that we don't have a kitchen. It's a microwave and a toaster and a coffee pot. But that's something, you know, and that's a lot. People can heat up water and, you know, make a cup of noodles and take off. If they need to, we hope to get, we just got a small fridge in there, a short one. And so we'll have some, you know, condiments, butter, cream cheese for like toast and all those things. So we'll have those in there. And then we hope to get a freezer and we'll be able to buy, you know, get some bulk items that people can heat up and go if they just are hungry. You know, a lot of the people who come in are there to access our services. In fact, I'm not sure. There's only been maybe one or two people that have come in just to hang out. And we have a foosball table. So we just got new balls for that because we didn't have any. And that was actually really cool because there was a couple of people playing it. And John, which is one of our peers, he was playing it with one of the guys and just sitting and talking, you know. And the conversation that comes out when you're engaging like that is so much better than when you're sitting in a little office. And it was just amazing to listen to him. And then, you know, walking in and kind of seeing Michelle going in there and doing intakes and things and just seeing things develop. And they're still co-locating up at St. Tim's. I haven't been up there just because obviously the office is consuming my every moment. But we are going to make special time to go up to St. Tim's, and they'll be up there quite a bit, you know, when it's open. So it actually, on Friday morning, was a bit slow because that's pizza day at St. Tim's until noon. Actually, until about 1.
Ba-boom.
So we're thinking we can kind of take advantage of those lulls in, you know, Jessica and I being able to do more admin or do any work that needs to be done on the center. There are going to be times, I should say our hours are Monday through Friday.
Well, you should tell us where it is first.
I'll give you the hours and then you just walk
it's
around.
Somewhere in Harbor.
No, and we don't have a banner up yet. So I can just say that, you know, we had a choice of, okay, do we wait a month and get these things in order, or do we open now while it's raining and give people the space? Yep. And then kind of build the house while we're living in it. And so we've decided to do that because we were ready anyway. We need we need some more space to be at. We did clear out some of the stuff at St. Timothy's and give a little bit of space back to Bernie, although it's still pretty messy in there sometimes. But and that's probably still us. I don't know.
Yeah.
So we are located at 97900 Shopping Center Avenue, and we're in Unit 10, and that's in Harbor. And we it's actually right next door to Lincare. So if people are driving into the shopping center where the DMV is, instead of turning left and going to the DMV, you would just go straight down the hill into the shopping center, and Lincare is like right in front of you, and we're the door to the left if you're looking at Lincare. We don't have our signs up, but I'm working on that the beginning of next week. So there are a couple of signs in the window that would indicate, and our lights will be on, you know, people will be in there. So we're open.
And you're mm-hmm. open, yeah. What are your hours?
Monday through Friday, we'll be open 9 to 4. And because of the nature of what we do, and because there are always crises and emergencies, and because we're people and we have families, mm-hmm. these hours are going to be flexible, probably until we're fully staffed. And I would say 8 staff feels like that would be fully staffed. Or we're able to, you know, recruit some volunteers to help us staff the lobby when we need to. So we have a policy where only one, you have to have 2 people in the building, 2 staff people in the building to have community members in the building. And it doesn't matter who those community members are. And it's not because of it. I mean, that's a safety protocol in general, but it's really has to do with, you know, if somebody's in the center and they need help. It could be anything. It could be they need 911. Mm-hmm. We do need somebody else manning the center in case somebody else is in need or something happens.
Yep.
So yep. There's always has to be 2 staff in the building. So there will be times where we have 2 staff and one has to go and the other one can't get there for a half hour or an hour, or maybe even that day they can't get there. Right. And so what that will mean is that we have to close the center. And that, you know, if that person is still wanting to see people, they'd have to probably just sit outside with a chair and chat with people. But essentially, it would mean we're closing the center for, and we hope to avoid that as much as possible. But that's sort of what happens sometimes with businesses.
So. You're a brand new organization that is, you know,
right.
that has just moved into a new space. So, I mean, really, I think everybody's going to give you a little bit.
I think so. It's, I mean, grace, it is, it happens know. With business anyway, but this is a little yep. bit different of a nature. You know, if you've got to yeah. close a furniture store because somebody's not coming in, I mean, that yeah, you might lose the sales for that day, but nobody's standing in the rain. So it right. it does bring a different emotional aspect to mm-hmm. having to close the building. But I think if we keep mm-hmm. that light and we're like, hey, we understand the need for people to be inside and be safe, but we also are, you know, only capable of doing what we're actually capable of doing. So we can't work outside of our own scope and our own level of comfort and really our own legalities too, because some things are just smart and some things are legal and illegal. So,
right.
Yeah.
So part of the challenge of any nonprofit is securing funding.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time, that's in the form of grants,
mm-hmm.
which kind of takes us to Measure 110 funding, because there's been some movement on mm-hmm. that. So where does that stand right now?
Well, currently, Curry County is already kind of a done deal in the sense that there are 3 organizations that applied. 2 were awarded funding under negotiations. And we met last Friday, not yesterday, but we're taping this on Saturday, the 14th. So the first Friday of the month, we met to talk about the Measure 110 funding with Jerry. And for people who don't know, the Measure 110, this is the funding that is coming down from a bill that was passed by the Oregon, by the voters. In order to decriminalize small amounts of certain types of substances, and instead of them having some sort of criminal record afterward, they would have more of a penalty. So they would pay a fine. It'd be more like a traffic ticket, because we're talking about small amounts that are not, you know, likely to cause serious harm to the community, but to them possibly. And so the idea is to kind of divert some people away from the jails, where the jails do not want to take people in who are struggling with mental illness and have addictions, because it's just not the appropriate placement. And they've said as much.
Right.
So this measure was really to address that issue, but also to address it from a harm reduction standpoint. And, you know, I think we've talked about harm reduction before, and just the sense of, well, you know, like condoms are harm reduction, and seatbelts and things like that. So, yeah, this, you know, they're wanting to say, okay, what's the root of the use, and how can we start chipping away at that? And that, you know, from my own personal experience and many others, oftentimes that comes out best when you're doing it under a treatment setting and a mental health setting and a somebody who's keeping after your physical health, and not so much from a punitive standpoint. There are a lot of people who have gotten a lot of great help in jail. And I've actually, you know, as a part of Narcotics Anonymous, even over in Jackson County, I was a part of the H&I, which is hospitals and institutions. And we would go into hospitals and jails and centers, and we would share our stories, and we would talk to people. And there are people who their lives are changed by that. But that is not the least traumatic environment possible. It's not the least.
I would think it would be the most traumatic environment.
And even if it wasn't, I mean, even if there was something worse, which I don't know what would be worse than that, but even if there was, that's still, you know, when we talk about kids in the school system who have disabilities and are on IEPs or 504s, they, it's least restrictive environment. That's what they're going for. They're trying to give as much, well, they're trying to really give that conditional, unconditional positive regard to these people and say that they believe with the right support that they actually would make better choices, which, you know, it's more in depth than that.
Generally, but generally people do that.
Yes.
With the right support, people generally make better choices.
I think we all make the best choice we can. And that sounds to some people not true, but that is true. We all make the best choice that we know how to make. And when I'm really...
At any given moment.
Yes. When I'm really mad, the best choice I know how to make sometimes is to cuss or throw something. And that's not helpful. But that's, I mean, helpful and reality are two very different things. And I live in reality. So harm reduction definitely is us trying to just reduce the harm that people are doing to themselves and to the environment, to people around them. And then they tend to want to get better. So there's a lot more to it than that. But
that's, I love it. I just love
that. That was the Measure 110. And so last Friday, Jerry from ADAPT, we met, and his team, and then with the people from OHA. And really what it comes down to is the negotiations are, you know, us with ADAPT. If we weren't able to reach any negotiations, you know, like say a Multnomah County that's receiving $50 million as opposed to us receiving $1.5 million, you know, they probably need some assistance with OHA to get these MOUs going and to negotiate this funding, because everybody's going to say, like, well, I can't give this up. With Curry County, it's pretty simple. Jerry and I sit down, and, you know, he has his team, I'm sure, that he has to report to. And so there are other people involved in that decision. But essentially, you know, we sit down and say, okay, where can we budge? And we're very, very close to the amount already, just because ADAPT has agreed to seek funding elsewhere for the larger projects. So
that's great.
We don't have any issue here with, you know, getting along and just kind of getting this done. But it's going to be a transition into really filling those services that are so desperately needed.
So there's something called a burn.
Yeah.
That, okay.
Burn baby burn. Yeah.
Burn baby burn, yeah. But it's BHRN, which is behavioral health
I'm just going to let her go
resource
on this.
Resource Network?
Yeah, look at you.
Really?
Yeah, did you got it. Yeah, Behavioral All Health right. Resource Network, which is an interesting acronym. I don't know, you know, whatever. Burn.
Right, right.
So,
but is that kind of what you and ADAPT are forming?
Yeah, yeah. Every county is required to have a full burn. And, you know, I really should have printed out the actual components of the burn. That would have been very helpful today. Maybe I can touch on that another time. So, but essentially, I can remember a few. Harm reduction is one. So it's all based around harm reduction. They want you to have the modeling, but harm reduction as a practice, as in, do you have a program of harm reduction? And so there's harm reduction, peer support, housing, substance use, and there's probably some others, mental health.
Right.
I can't quite remember all of them, but
right.
ASAM, so which is when you usually someone who's a certified alcohol and drug counselor is able to do these types of assessments called an ASAM, which determines what level of placement you would need in a treatment center. And so, you know, do you need detox or do you just need some outpatient? And so that's part of the burn. There, we have to have people who are able to do ASAMs. And so there's all these categories. And in order for the funding to come down, they want to see full burns. They want to see a component in, you know, they want to see it crossed off every single component, every category, is somehow some organization covering some piece of this burn. And in some cases, one organization might be a full burn. And for Curry County, we're very lucky in that ADAPT is a full burn.
Oh,
and so
nice.
We already have one. But the great thing is that we also, now that, because we also got funded, we have a full burn and we have another component of an kind of an extra component.
Which is great.
And we can be more, I was going to say adaptable, which is true.
But but also efficient.
Yeah, of
because
course.
Because there's more, right?
And it's,
there's more.
It's, you know, it's relative to Curry County. Does it mean that we have the same housing coming in and the same, you know, is are people going to see seven apartment complexes open up? No. But what this means is that ADAPT is going to be fulfilling every single part of this burn, and we'll be able to come alongside them and provide a lot of referral pathways, which is what we already do with ADAPT. So these MOUs, these contracts, these are going to be fairly easy for us to flush out, I think. We already do a lot of the work together. So that's
excellent.
And you know what's really going to be fascinating is to see how this develops over a period of, you know, 2 years, 5 years. How much more funding are we going to get? Because it's going to increase. It's going to be, you know, is there's no such thing as like sustainable funding. It's not. We never know what's going to happen in the future. But right now, the plan is that this funding will continue every year. And so I'm very curious to see. A lot of our stuff, it's kind of like a pilot program, not really in the sense that they already know how it's going to work, but it's kind of like that. And so we'll be doing a lot of reporting back to, and the state's going to be gathering a lot of information on how different all of these burns work and what works well. And so they'll be able to really inform kind of a lot of decisions and help us improve our services. I think
I love it.
There obviously there's going to be issues along the way. There always are delays,
of course,
you know, different things. But
yeah,
I see this as a really good opportunity for Curry County.
Yeah, I'm absolutely thrilled. I just think it's you know, any more services that we can get, dynamite.
Yeah,
right?
I'm curious, dynamite. Like when this. Hopefully when this funding increases every year, like what other services are going to come on board? You know, are there other organizations that are now looking at it here locally and thinking like, you know, we could probably fulfill a piece of this burn. And my, you know, my take on that is that there's always room for more. And if somebody's bringing on peer support, and right now our current burn between us and ADAPT, we have two organizations doing peer support, because that's what we qualified under. I should clarify. We applied under peer support, and that's the only category we applied under. We could have applied under a couple, but we didn't feel that we had the structure and the capacity to say we're clear that we're applying for that.
Right.
So, and you know, another organization bringing on peer support, while sometimes I think that, you know, we have to sit down and kind of figure out like who's doing what, duplication is not always a bad thing. You know, we have St. Right. Tim's and now we have our day center, and the first people we started seeing out at the day center are the people who, you know, can't necessarily go to St. Tim's or, mm-hmm. you know, aren't really welcome at a lot of places in Brookings. And so mm-hmm. there's very few things that we're duplicating over there, but it's good that we are, because some people aren't accessing them at St. Tim's. But there's some things that we are, you know, St. Tim's, and in town, there are meals every day for lunch. And so we're not, you know, obviously we're not providing any meals at all, but we're encouraging people to attend those meals. You know, there's already mail service at St. Timothy's. And so there's things that we don't have to reinvent the wheel or duplicate.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
So you used the phrase unconditional personal regard.
Positive regard. Unconditional positive.
Positive.
Yes.
Unconditional positive. So I knew there was a P in there.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's positive, not personal.
Yeah. Yeah, like.
So what does that mean?
It's kind of, most people understand this in the text of like client-centered therapy. And so not necessarily in just the general sense, but Carl Rogers, this wasn't really, the concept wasn't developed by Carl Rogers. It was developed by a different, I think he was a psychologist, Standel. And then a couple of years later, Carl Rogers kind of made it popular, the theory of unconditional positive regard. And he says that it's the kind of caring that the client-centered therapist desires to achieve, and it's a gullible caring in which clients are accepted as they are, not with like a lurking suspicion in the therapist's mind that they may in fact be otherwise. So this attitude is not stupidity on the therapist's part. It's kind of attitude that is most likely to lead to trust. And I think that was by Carl Rogers. So
that's kind of assuming that, rather than assuming that your client is lying to you, you're assuming that they're telling you the truth.
It's not actually even assuming that someone's telling you the truth. It kind of is, but it's really just the caring part of it. You could tell yourself, okay, we need to be honest with ourselves as practitioners and providers. We're peer support specialists. And so when we're talking with someone who's having, thoughts of grandiose and we have one person who thinks that they own the port, and we're not assuming that they're telling the truth.
Right.
We are caring for them in a way that means, you know, we don't care about any of those things. We care about you. And we don't care about whether or not that's true. So we just don't care about that. Because that doesn't really matter when we're working with people, whether they're telling the truth or not. It's like, it's kind of an attitude of complete acceptance and love, whether it's for yourself or for someone else. And so when you have unconditional positive regard, nothing they can do gives you a reason to stop seeing them as inherently human and inherently lovable. And that's probably not a well-known concept, I imagine that's probably not a well-known concept unless you're in the world of psychology, but that's something that we can use. Just we do use it, actually. It's I approve of my child without condition, although I may not approve of all of the choices that my child makes. So I give my kids permission to make mistakes, and I believe in their ability to learn from them. We do that anyway. When babies learn to walk, we let them do that. And we find that often they don't injure themselves in the way that we think. And it's a little bit hard to compare it in that way, but that's the feeling, is the unconditional positive regard. I believe in my child's ability to become who they are meant to be. And so we believe that about, we we try to cultivate and practice believing that about ourselves, about each other, mm-hmm. about other colleagues that are working in the field, about the clients mm-hmm. that we're seeing, about community members. And I think that's something that we, you know, don't have necessarily saturated in our every day and every thought, but it's something that we're working towards, because that's how we help people get through. And that's kind of how peer support works. And it's kind of the same idea when you're working in therapy. It's a more specific purpose, though. It's not just to have that general positive regard. It's like building a positive, trusting relationship with that person and ourselves. And so it's a defining feature of client-centered therapy, which we don't do therapy, but we do provide a lot of informal support.
Well, and certainly people who have experienced trauma, mm-hmm. And a lot of people who are living on the edge or who have had the experience of living on the edge, have that trauma that they've experienced. Mm-hmm. And that can often prevent you from forming a bond of trust, mm-hmm. that trauma, especially if, you know, somebody that you trusted at one point, betrayed that trust in some way, shape, or form. And
right.
So I can see where building that kind of a relationship with the people that you're trying to help would make the help a lot easier. It would just kind of smooth the way.
I mean, I wish we could all do this just for people in general, especially people we see who are down and out, if we could have an mm-hmm. unconditional positive regard, because it doesn't hurt anyone. It doesn't mm-hmm. cause any damage. It doesn't encourage people to abuse systems or do things that they wouldn't otherwise do. What it does is it encourages them to share more openly and more deeply, which they do with us. They do share more with us. Mm-hmm. People share with us when they're using, and people share with us when they've OD'd, and they share with us when they have, you know, been the victim of abuse and things like that, where, you know, those are very difficult things to talk to someone about that mm-hmm. is not necessarily in a friend role. And so, you know, we do have to toe that line because we're peers. We're not friends, though. If we step into friendship, then we step into a lot of emotional entanglement that we can't easily step out of. And so we, you know, when they struggle, we struggle, and we want to save them, and we can't always do that. And so then we turn on each other and we get upset. And that's when we lose that unconditional positive regard for our peers, mm-hmm. our colleagues. And we say they don't care as much mm-hmm. because they're not doing A, B, and C. And I've been guilty of that as well. I can't tell you how, when I worked at All Care, how many doctor's offices I was like, this doctor's office doesn't care. This patient is not getting treatment and they need to be doing better. And, you know, thankfully I had a really great mentor at All Care who was in a great team that was very helpful. And so I learned that it didn't do me any good to assume that somebody was, it didn't change the outcome. And actually sometimes it did change it in a way that was negative. And so I don't have unconditional positive regard for my colleagues because I want them to hurry. I do it because it doesn't matter anyway. Whether I am upset or not. And so it's the same with clients, you know, it's the same with, and we don't necessarily call them clients because they're our peers. And I mean, there are people that I've went to school with and known for years. So really, I think that how we can do this, how we can have unconditional positive regard, we can facilitate that in ourselves by keeping in mind the belief that all people have the internal resources required for personal growth. It just may not be the personal growth that we see for them, but that's neither here nor there. So having
their personal growth is theirs.
And so having unconditional positive regard for the people that we see that are down and out by just caring for mm-hmm. them and not feeling like, you know, when somebody's telling you something that's going on, don't feel like you have to fix it. Sometimes you just need to listen. And so that helps you have unconditional positive regard, because it doesn't make it about you. And it makes it about just listening and just being there and saying, I understand sometimes, if you do understand.
And it does underline the premise that they already have the resources to solve their problems. Mm-hmm. They already have them. They may not have the resources that you're going to provide for them in terms of the DMV or, you know, navigating the system or whatever, but they have the internal strength to do it. And it's kind of insulting if you assume that they don't.
Yes. And when you assume that they don't, you feel you need to save. And then you lose your unconditional positive regard for others who cannot possibly save.
Yep. Yeah.
Which we can't.
And
we
you
can't
become,
possibly.
Right, you become this savior.
Yes.
Which
and you burn
doesn't
out.
Work.
And we've all, we've all done some part of that. We've all had some piece. Anybody who's been any kind of advocate, activist, anybody who's, you know, been involved in any level, we've all gotten over-involved at some point. And maybe sometimes that was just needed. In our case, there have been times where, like we've been so heavily involved with some people. And I'm still, you know, especially because we came into a situation where there's really just not a lot of connection to services. I won't say we don't have services. But because of that, there were some people who were just critically in need. And we did step in and we held up a lot more than we normally would. So, you know, we're working to help create capacity in the community that's unsheltered, the community that is in need, and also within ourselves.
Right, right. And I would think that, you know, that kind of emotional involvement definitely takes its toll.
It does. Right? There's, re-traumatization and sort of there's, you know, when people pass sort of emotions from the client to the therapist, there's, it's called transference.
Transference,
and so we, you know, again, not therapists, but because this is what we do all day, there is transference at times, and we do deal with that, and sometimes we don't necessarily sit and call it out, and so we're working to do more of that, too.
It's fascinating to me. I mean, you are, you're treading a road that I am just really amazed and impressed when I watch what you do. It's
well, I mean, if you see the team in action, you'll know why.
I do. I do. You guys are
amazing. I've been able to step back more and more, and it's been kind of really comforting. And Michelle's the program lead, and, you know, Jessica's the assistant right now, and then we have John as another THW. But Michelle's really stepping into a lead, and Jessica's kind of taking some stuff from me. So
You guys are amazing. All right, so I hate to tell you this, but it looks like we're out of
just
time.
Just keep
again.
Talking. It's fine.
I know, right? Just let Tom deal with the overage, right? 10 seconds. So thanks for coming on, Diana. Mm-hmm. I knew this was going to be a good conversation, and it absolutely was. And, you know, maybe we can get Lauren Farmer back on pretty soon.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd love to talk about COVID and Curry again, and maybe we can talk about Project Turnkey sometime soon. So I want to thank our listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you next week. This is Candace Michelle for Our Community.